The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the September 18, 2017 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Case Against Civilization. Did our hunter-gatherer ancestors have it better? By John Lanchester. Science and technology, we tend to think of them as siblings, perhaps even as twins, as parts of STEM for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. When it comes to the shiniest wonders of the modern world, as the supercomputers in our pockets communicate with satellites, science and technology are indeed hand in glove. For much of human history, though, technology had nothing to do with science. Many of our most significant inventions are pure tools, with no scientific method behind them. Wheels and wells, cranks and mills and gears, and ships' masts and clocks and rudders and crop rotation, all have been crucial to human and economic development, and none, historically, had any connection with what we think of today as science. Some of the most important things we use every day were invented long before the adoption of the scientific method. I love my laptop and my iPhone and my Echo and my GPS, but the piece of technology I would be most reluctant to give up, the one that changed my life from the first day I used it, and that I'm still reliant on every waking hour, am reliant on right now as I sit typing, dates from the 13th century. My glasses. Soap prevented more deaths than penicillin. That's technology, not science. In Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, James C. Scott, a professor of political science at Yale, presents a plausible contender for the most important piece of technology in the history of man. It is a technology so old that it predates Homo sapiens and instead should be credited to our ancestor Homo erectus. That technology is fire. We have used it in two crucial defining ways. The first and the most obvious of these is cooking. As Richard Wrangham has argued in his book, Catching Fire, our ability to cook allows us to extract more energy from the food we eat and also to eat a far wider range of foods. Our closest animal relative, the chimpanzee, has a colon three times as large as ours because its diet of raw food is so much harder to digest. The extra caloric value we get from cooked food allowed us to develop our big brains, which absorb roughly a fifth of the energy we consume, as opposed to less than a tenth for most mammals' brains. That difference is what has made us the dominant species on the planet. The other reason fire was central to our history is less obvious to contemporary eyes. We used it to adapt the landscape around us to our purposes. Hunter-gatherers would set fires as they moved to clear terrain and make it ready for fast-growing, prey-attracting new plants. They would also drive animals with fire. They used this technology so much that Scott thinks we should date the human-dominated phase of Earth, the so-called Anthropocene, from the time our forebears mastered this new tool. We don't give the technology of fire enough credit, Scott suggests, because we don't give our ancestors much credit for their ingenuity over the long period, 95% of human history, during which most of our species were hunter-gatherers. Why human fire as landscape architecture doesn't register as it ought to in our historical accounts is perhaps that its effects were spread over hundreds of millennia and were accomplished by pre-civilized peoples, also known as savages, Scott writes. To demonstrate the significance of fire, he points to what we found in certain caves in southern Africa. The earliest, oldest strata of the caves contain whole skeletons of carnivores and many chewed-up bone fragments of the things they were eating, including us. Then comes the layer from when we discovered fire, and ownership of the cave switches. The human skeletons are whole, and the carnivores are bone fragments. Fire is the difference between eating lunch and being lunch. Anatomically, modern humans have been around for roughly 200,000 years. For most of that time, we lived as hunter-gatherers. Then, about 12,000 years ago, came what is generally agreed to be the definitive before and after moment in our ascent to planetary dominance, the Neolithic Revolution. This was our adoption of, to use Scott's word, a package of agricultural innovations, notably the domestication of animals such as the cow and the pig, and the transition from hunting and gathering to planting and cultivating crops. The most important of these crops have been the cereals, wheat, barley, rice, and maize, that remain the staples of humanity's diet. Cereals allowed population growth and the birth of cities, and hence the development of states and the rise of complex societies. The story told in Against the Grain heavily revises this widely held account. Scott's specialty is not early human history. His work has focused on a skeptical, peasant's eye view of state formation. The trajectory of his interest can be traced in the titles of his books, from The Moral Economy of the Peasant to The Art of Not Being Governed. His best-known book, Seeing Like a State, has become a touchstone for political scientists and amounts to a blistering critique of central planning and high modernism, the idea that officials at the center of a state know better than the people they are governing. Scott argues that a state's interest and the interests of subjects are often not just different, but opposite. Stalin's project of farm collectivization served well enough as a means whereby the state could determine cropping patterns, fix real rural wages, appropriate a large share of whatever grain was produced, and politically emasculate the countryside. It also killed many millions of peasants. Scott's new book extends these ideas into the deep past and draws on existing research to argue that ours is not a story of linear progress, that the timeline is much more complicated, and that the causal sequences of the standard version are wrong. He focuses his account on Mesopotamia, roughly speaking, modern-day Iraq, because it is the heartland of the first pristine states in the world, the term pristine here meaning that these states bore no watermark from earlier settlements, and were the first time any such social organizations had existed. They were the first states to have written records, and they became a template for other states in the Near East and in Egypt, making them doubly relevant to later history. The big news to emerge from recent archaeological research concerns the time lag between sedentism, or living in settled communities, and the adoption of agriculture. Previous scholarship held that the invention of agriculture made sedentism possible. The evidence shows that this isn't true. There's an enormous gap, 4,000 years, separating the two key domestications of animals and cereals from the first agrarian economies based on them. Our ancestors evidently took a good, hard look at the possibility of agriculture before deciding to adopt this new way of life. They were able to think it over for so long because the life they lived was remarkably abundant. Like the early civilization of China and the Yellow River Valley, Mesopotamia was a wetland territory, as its name, Between the Rivers, suggests. In the Neolithic period, Mesopotamia was a delta wetland where the sea came many miles inland from its current shore. This was a generous landscape for humans, offering fish and the animals that preyed on them, fertile soil left behind by regular flooding, migratory birds, and migratory prey traveling near the river routes. The first settled communities were established here because the land offered such a diverse web of food sources. If one year a food source failed, another would still be present. The archaeology shows, then, that the Neolithic package of domestication and agriculture did not lead to settled communities, the ancestors of our modern towns and cities and states. Those communities had been around for thousands of years, living in the bountiful conditions of the wetlands before humanity committed to intensive agriculture. Reliance on a single, densely planted cereal crop was much riskier. And it's no wonder people took a few millennia to make the change. So why did our ancestors switch from this complex web of food supplies to the concentrated production of single crops? We don't know, although Scott speculates that climactic stress may have been involved. Two things, however, are clear. The first is that for thousands of years, the agricultural revolution was, for most of the people living through it, a disaster. The fossil record shows that life for agriculturalists was harder than it had been for hunter-gatherers. Their bones show evidence of dietary stress. They were shorter. They were sicker. Their mortality rates were higher. Living in close proximity to domesticated animals led to diseases that crossed the species barrier, wreaking havoc in the densely settled communities. Scott calls them not towns, but late Neolithic multi-species resettlement camps. Who would choose to live in one of those? Jared Diamond called the Neolithic Revolution the worst mistake in human history. The startling thing about this claim is that, among historians of the era, it isn't very controversial. The other conclusion we can draw from the evidence, Scott says, is that there is a crucial direct link between the cultivation of cereal crops and the birth of the first states. It's not that cereal grains were humankind's only staples. It's just that they were the only ones that encouraged the formation of states. History records no cassava states, no yam, taro, plantain, breadfruit, or sweet potato states, he writes. What was so special about grains? The answer will make sense to anyone who has ever filled out a Form 1040. Grain, unlike other crops, is easy to tax. Some crops, potatoes, sweet potatoes, cassava, are buried and so can be hidden from the tax collector. And, even if discovered, they must be dug up individually and laboriously. Other crops, notably legumes, ripen at different intervals or yield harvest throughout a growing season rather than along a fixed trajectory of unripe to ripe. In other words, the taxman can't come once and get his proper due. Only grains are, in Scott's words, visible, divisible, accessible, storable, transportable, and rationable. Other crops have some of these advantages, but only cereal grains have them all. And so grain became the main food starch, the unit of taxation in kind, and the basis for a hegemonic agrarian calendar. The taxman can come, assess the fields, set a level of tax, and then come back and make sure he's got his share of the harvest. It was the ability to tax and to extract a surplus from the produce of agriculture that, in Scott's account, led to the birth of the state, and also to the creation of complex societies with hierarchies, division of labor, specialist jobs, soldier, priest, servant, administrator, and an elite presiding over them. Because the new states required huge amounts of manual work to irrigate the cereal crops, they also required forms of forced labor, including slavery. Because the easiest way to find slaves was to capture them, the states had a new propensity for waging war. Some of the earliest images in human history, from the first Mesopotamian states, are of slaves being marched along in neck shackles. Add this to the frequent epidemics and the general ill health of early settled communities, and it is not hard to see why the latest consensus is that the Neolithic Revolution was a disaster for most of the people who lived through it. War, slavery, rule by elites, all were made easier by another new technology of control, writing. It is virtually impossible to conceive of even the earliest states without a systematic technology of numerical record keeping, Scott maintains. All the good things we associate with writing, its use for culture and entertainment and communication and collective memory, were some distance in the future. For 500 years after its invention in Mesopotamia, writing was used exclusively for bookkeeping. The massive effort through a system of notation to make a society, its manpower, and its production legible to its rulers and temple officials, and to extract grain and labor from it. Every tablet consists of lists, 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 Scott says, and the subjects of that record keeping are, in order of frequency, barley, as rations and taxes, war captives, male and female slaves. Walter Benjamin, the great Jewish cultural critic who committed suicide while trying to escape Nazi-controlled Europe, said that there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. He meant that every complicated and beautiful thing humanity ever made has, if you look at it long enough, a shadow, a history of oppression. As a matter of plain historical fact, that seems right. It was a long and traumatic journey from the invention of writing to your book club's discussion of Jodi Picoult's latest. We need to rethink, accordingly, what we mean when we talk about ancient dark ages. Scott's question is trenchant. Dark for whom and in what respects? The historical record shows that early cities and states were prone to sudden implosion. Over the roughly 5 millennia of sporadic sedentism before states, 7 millennia if we include pre-agricultural sedentism in Japan and the Ukraine, he writes that archaeologists have recorded hundreds of locations that were settled, then abandoned, perhaps resettled, and then again abandoned. These events are usually spoken of as collapses. But Scott invites us to scrutinize that term, too. When states collapse, fancy buildings stop being built, the elites no longer run things, written records stop being kept, and the mass of the population goes to live somewhere else. Is that a collapse in terms of living standards for most people? Human beings mainly lived outside the purview of states until, by Scott's reckoning, about the year 1600 AD. Until that date, marking the last 0.2% of humanity's political life, much of the world's population might never have met that hallmark of the state, a tax collector. The question of what it was like to live outside the settled culture of a state is therefore an important one for the overall assessment of human history. If that life was, as Thomas Hobbes described it, nasty, brutish, and short, this is a vital piece of information for drawing up the account of how we got to be who we are. In essence, human history would become a straightforward story of progress. Most of us were miserable most of the time. We developed civilization. Everything got better. If most of us were not miserable most of the time, the arrival of civilization is a more ambiguous event. In one column of the ledger, we would have the development of a complex material culture permitting the glories of modern science and medicine and the accumulated wonders of art. In the other column, we would have the less good stuff, such as plague, war, slavery, social stratification, rule by mercilessly appropriating elites, and Simon Cowell. To know what it is like to live as people live for most of human history, you would have to find one of the places where traditional hunting and gathering practices are still alive. You would have to spend a lot of time there to make sure that what you were seeing wasn't just a snapshot, and that you had a real sense of the texture of lived experience, and, ideally, you would need a point of comparison. People with close similarities to your hunter-gatherers, but who lived differently. so that you would have a scientific control that allowed you to rule out local accidents of circumstance. Fortunately for us, the anthropologist James Sussman did exactly that. He spent more than two decades visiting, studying, and living among the Bushmen of the Kalahari in Southwest Africa. It's a story he recounts in his new book, Affluence Without Abundance, The Disappearing World of the Bushmen. The Bushmen have long been of interest to anthropologists and scientists. About 150,000 years ago, 50,000 years after the emergence of the first anatomically modern humans, one group of Homo sapiens was living in southern Africa. The Bushmen, or Khoisan, are still there, the oldest growth on the human family tree. The Bushmen, once derogatory, is now used by the people themselves and by NGOs, invoking, as it does, a set of positive if romantic stereotypes, Sussman notes, though some Khoisan prefer to use the term San. The genetic evidence suggests that for much of the 150,000 years, they were the largest population of biologically modern humans. Their languages use palatal clicks, such as a made by bringing the tongue back from the front teeth while gently sucking in air, and the click we make by pushing the tongue against the roof of the mouth and then bringing it suddenly downward. This raises the fascinating possibility that click languages are the oldest surviving variety of speech. Sussman first visited the Bushmen in 1992. And went to stay with them 2 years later as part of the research for his PhD. The group he knows best are the Ju Huanxi, between 8 and 10,000 of whom are alive today, occupying the borderlands between Namibia and Botswana. The Ju Huanxi are about 10% of the total Bushman population in southern Africa, and they are divided into a northern group who retain significant control over their traditional lands, and who, therefore, still have the ability to practice hunting and gathering, and a southern group who were deprived of their lands and resettled into modern ways of living. To a remarkable extent, Sussman's study of the Bushmen supports the ideas of against the grain. The encounter with modernity has been disastrous for the Bushmen. Sussman's portrait of the dispossessed, alienated, suffering Ju Huanxi in their miserable resettlement camps makes that clear. The two books even confirm each other's account of that sinister new technology called writing. Sussman's Bushman mentor noted that whenever he started work at any new farm, his name would be entered into an employment ledger, documents that over the decades had assumed great mystical power among the Ju Huanxi on the farms. The secrets held by these ledgers evidently had the power to give or withhold pay, issue rations, and determine an individual's right to stay on any particular farm. It turns out that hunting and gathering is a good way to live. A study from 1966 found that it took a Ju Huanxi about 17 hours a week, on average, to find an adequate supply of food. Another 19 hours were spent on domestic activities and chores. The average caloric intake of the hunter-gatherers was 2,300 a day, close to the recommended amount. At the time these figures were first established, a comparable week in the United States involved 40 hours of work and 36 hours of domestic labor. Ju Huanxi do not accumulate surpluses. They get all the food they need and then stop. They exhibit what Sussman calls an unyielding confidence that their environment will provide for their needs. The web of food sources that the hunting and gathering Ju Huanxi use is, exactly as Scott argues for Neolithic people, a complex one, with a wide range of animal protein, including porcupines, kudu, wildebeest, and elephants, and 125 edible plant species with different seasonal cycles, ecological niches, and responses to weather fluctuations. Hunter-gatherers need not only an unwritten almanac of dietary knowledge, but what Scott calls a library of almanacs. As he suggests, the step down in complexity between hunting and gathering and domesticated agriculture is as big as the step down between domesticated agriculture and routine assembly work on a production line. The news here is that the lives of most of our progenitors were better than we think. We're flattering ourselves by believing that their existence was so grim that our modern civilized one is, by comparison, so great. Still, we are where we are, and we live the way we live, and it's possible to wonder whether any of this illuminating knowledge about our hunter-gatherer ancestors can be useful to us. Sussman wonders the same thing. He discusses John Maynard Keynes' famous 1930 essay, The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. Keynes speculated that if the world continued to get richer, we would naturally end up enjoying a high standard of living while doing much less work. He thought that the economic problem of having enough to live on would be solved and the struggle for subsistence would be over. Keynes wrote the following: when the accumulation of wealth is no longer of high social importance, there will be great changes in the code of morals. We shall be able to rid ourselves of many of the pseudo-moral principles which have hag-ridden us for 200 years, by which we have exalted some of the most distasteful of human qualities into the position of the highest virtues. We shall be able to afford to dare to assess the money motive at its true value. The love of money as a possession, as distinguished from the love of money as a means to the enjoyments and realities of life, will be recognized for what it is, a somewhat disgusting morbidity, one of those semi-criminal, semi-pathological propensities which one hands over with a shudder to the specialist in mental disease. The world has indeed got richer, but any such shift in morals and values is hard to detect. Money and the value system around its acquisition are fully intact. Greed is still good. The study of hunter-gatherers, who live for the day and do not accumulate surpluses, shows that humanity can live more or less as Keynes suggests. It's just that we're choosing not to. A key to that lost or forsworn ability, Sussman suggests, lies in the ferocious egalitarianism of hunter-gatherers. For example, the most valuable thing a hunter can do is come back with meat. Unlike gathered plants, whose proceeds are not subject to any strict conventions on sharing, hunted meat is very carefully distributed according to protocol. And the people who eat the meat that is given to them go to great trouble to be rude about it. This ritual is called insulting the meat, and it is designed to make sure the hunter doesn't get above himself and start thinking that he's better than anyone else. When a young man kills much meat, a bushman told the anthropologist Richard B. Lee, he comes to think of himself as a chief or a big man, and he thinks of the rest of us as his servants or inferiors. We cannot accept this. The insults are designed to cool his heart and make him gentle. For these hunter-gatherers, Sussman writes, the sum of individual self-interest and the jealousy that policed it was a fiercely egalitarian society where profitable exchange, hierarchy, and significant material inequality were not tolerated. This egalitarian impulse, Sussman suggests, is central to the hunter-gatherer's ability to live a life that is, on its own terms, affluent, but without abundance, without excess, and without competitive acquisition. The secret ingredient seems to be the positive harnessing of the general human impulse to envy. As he says, if this kind of egalitarianism is a precondition for us to embrace a post-labor world, then I suspect it may prove a very hard nut to crack. There's a lot that we could learn from the oldest extant branch of humanity. But that doesn't mean we're going to put that knowledge into effect. a socially positive use of envy, now that would be a technology almost as useful as fire. Next, from the January 7, 2016 online edition of The New Yorker, How We Learn Fairness by Maria Konnikova. A pair of brown capuchin monkeys are sitting in a cage. From time to time, their caretakers give them tokens, which they can then exchange for food. It's a truth universally acknowledged that capuchin monkeys prefer grapes to cucumbers. So what happens when unfairness strikes? When, in exchange for identical tokens, one monkey gets a cucumber and the other a grape? When Sarah Brosnan and Franz Duval carried out just this experiment in 2003, focusing on female capuchin monkeys, they found that monkeys hate being disadvantaged. A monkey in isolation is happy to eat either a grape or a slice of cucumber. But a monkey who sees that she's received a cucumber while her partner has gotten a grape reacts with anger. She might hurl her cucumber from her cage. Some primates, Brosnan and Duval concluded, dislike inequity. They hate getting the short end of the stick. Psychologists have a technical term for this reaction. They call it disadvantageous inequity aversion. This instinctual aversion to getting less than others has been found in chimpanzees and dogs, and it occurs, of course, in people in whom it seems to develop from a young age. The psychologists Alessandra Grassi and Luca Surian have found, for example, that babies as young as 12 months prefer fair-minded cartoon animals to unfair ones. And yet, for humans, an aversion to getting less is just one aspect of unfairness. Unlike other animals, we sometimes balk at receiving more than other people. Technically speaking, we experience advantageous inequity aversion. In some situations, we'll even give up something good because it's more than someone else is getting. In those moments, we seek to ensure that the distribution of goods remains fair. We don't want the long end of the stick either. It seems likely that our aversion to being disadvantaged is innate because we share it with other animals. The question for psychologists is whether our aversion to benefiting from inequality is innate too, or alternatively, if it's learned through some sort of socialization. In December, the psychologists Peter Blake, Catherine McAuliffe, Felix Varnikin, and their colleagues published the results of experiments designed to answer this question. Their research spanned seven nations: India, Uganda, Peru, Senegal, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, and looked at close to 900 children aged 4 to 15. They examined whether advantageous inequity aversion, AI as they call it, emerges in all cultures, and if it does, whether it emerges in the same way everywhere. Their method was relatively simple. They sat two children down at a table, each in front of an empty bowl. Above each bowl was a tray onto which the experimenter placed candy. Often, she distributed the candy unfairly. She might place four candies on one tray and only one on the other. The child being tested then faced a choice. She could pull a green handle to accept the presented candies, causing them to fall into the respective bowls, or she could pull a red handle to reject them, causing all the candies to fall into a third off-limits bowl in the center. The researchers found that, all over the world, children tended to reject the candies when the split favored the other child. That is, they rejected disadvantageous inequity. They also found that some older kids would reject advantageous offers. None of that is surprising. Advantageous inequity aversion has been documented among adults many times in the past. in one early study from behavioral economist George Lewenstein and his colleagues, as many as 66% of participants disliked getting more than someone else. The surprising part is that the kids only displayed advantageous inequity aversion in three countries, Canada, the United States, and Uganda. In the other countries, Mexico, India, Senegal, and Peru, they enjoyed the sweet taste of inequality. These results raise some fascinating questions. Why were kids from only certain countries bothered by having an unfair advantage? And were they rejecting those unfair offers because they cared about fairness or for some other less obvious reason? It's helpful to start by stepping back from the more complicated case of advantageous inequity aversion to the simpler case of disadvantageous inequity aversion. There are lots of reasons to object to disadvantageous inequity, and some are more obvious than others. Disadvantageous inequity is bad substantively, of course, because you get less candy. But it's also bad socially, because it signals a demotion in status. In fact, when kids reject disadvantageous offers, they're often most concerned about their social status rather than with the candy itself or with abstract ideas like equality. It's not about right or wrong. It's all about me. How do I come off in this scenario? The importance of social hierarchy in the rejection of disadvantageous unfairness has been clearly demonstrated in several experiments. In one study, the psychologists Mark Sheshkin, Paul Bloom, and Karen Wynn had kids choose between getting one token and giving one to another child, or getting two tokens and giving three to the other kid. You might think that the latter is the better choice because both children get more, Bloom writes in his book, Just Babies. Often, though, the children chose the first option, just one token each, ensuring that they wouldn't get less than someone else. In another version of this study, Bloom and his colleagues offered a choice between two tokens all around, or one for the subject and none for her counterpart. 5- and 6-year-olds preferred the second option, that is, they gave up a reward in exchange for having more than their peers. We have a natural aversion to getting less, not to inequity, Bloom told me. The kids' behavior isn't principled. On the contrary, Bloom believes, it seems motivated by something very much like spite. And the message is clear. I want to emerge on top. The absolute number of candies matters less than my relative status. If disadvantageous inequity is really about status rather than fairness, could advantageous inequity be about status too? Rejecting an advantageous offer, after all, also sends a social signal. If you live in a society where ideas of fairness and equality hold a privileged position, then it becomes meaningful to show yourself as embracing those ideals, even at a personal cost. Those around you might feel that since you're the type of person who believes in equity no matter what, you're valuable to society and worthy of respect. From this perspective, both disadvantage inequity and advantageous inequity aversion achieve the same end, making sure you maintain status. Perhaps for older kids who are transitioning into adolescence, status doesn't always come from having more. It could also flow from being an admirable role model. If status really is the driving force behind both disadvantageous inequity and advantageous inequity aversion, it would explain one of the study's relative outliers, Mexico. When the experiment was run there, very few of the children exhibited advantageous inequity aversion. Moreover, disadvantageous inequity aversion appeared to develop far later than in other societies. The Mexican children, in other words, tended to accept all offers, however unequal in any direction. The authors point out that in that particular sample, most of the kids already knew each other, Perhaps they had already developed reputations, and, as a result, what happened in the experiment had no real implications for their social hierarchy. They were free to enjoy the candy all by itself without social signals on the side. Still, even if advantageous inequity and disadvantageous inequity aversion have a lot in common, even if they're both about status, the research from Blake and his colleagues suggests that they are different in at least one fundamental way. Disadvantage inequity aversion is innate, all over the world and in the animal kingdom. Getting less than others is perceived as an insult. Advantageous inequity aversion, on the other hand, seems to be a product of social life or culture. Globally, at least, among children, it appears to be very unevenly distributed. In Canada, the United States, and Uganda, the study shows that older kids are more likely, on average, to reject an advantageous offer than an equal offer. By contrast, in Mexico, Peru, India, and Senegal, they willingly accept getting more. In the past, studies of advantageous inequity aversion have focused on so-called weird societies, W-E-I-R-D, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. As a result, the uneven distribution of advantageous inequity aversion went beneath the radar. To explain its uneven distribution, Blake and his colleagues point to a number of potential causes. The most prominent is Western norms. They suggest that advantageous equity aversion is more prevalent in Western societies because, in the West, equality and the abstract notion of fairness are valued as goods in their own right. It's only within that framework that sacrificing your self-interest in the name of fairness comes to be linked with status. In recent years, of course, Western societies have been wrestling with the problem of rising inequality, an irony on which the researchers choose not to dwell. In an earlier study, McAuliffe, Blake, Varnikin, and their colleagues found that, while subjects exhibited disadvantageous inequity aversion even in the absence of a visible partner, advantageous inequity aversion only emerged in social situations. This suggests that advantageous inequity aversion might require certain kinds of social environments to thrive. If it's Western culture that encourages advantageous inequity aversion, then why is it so common in Uganda? Blake and his colleagues posit that the answer lies in the specific subset of the Ugandan population they surveyed. They recruited children from schools that had Western teachers and in which students were frequently exposed to Western researchers. Perhaps, they write, that environment had changed the students' sense of fairness. This reasoning seems a bit thin. Aren't other societies also exposed to Western norms, especially in the modern age of ubiquitous smartphones and mass media? It remains possible that children in Uganda reject an advantage for other reasons not linked to Western norms, the authors write. If this is the case, we would expect to see advantageous inequity aversion emerge in children in other communities in Uganda with similar cultural norms but different institutional structures. Behind the question of how Western advantageous inequity aversion is, a broader question looms. What factors in society could create a norm whereby it's valuable to establish yourself publicly as someone who doesn't want to receive more than others? In the same set of studies in which he found that, under some circumstances, up to 66% of adults experienced advantageous inequity aversion, George Lowenstein tried to tease out what condition might give rise to advantageous inequity aversion in the first place. He started by asking subjects to imagine themselves in a specific business scenario. In the first scenario, they had invented a new type of ski with someone. In another, they were splitting tax revenue from a vacant lot with a neighbor. And in a third, they were in conflict with a sales manager at a retail outlet. In each of these scenarios, their pre-existing relationship with their counterpart was described as positive, negative, or neutral. And the financial payments were either equal or representative of disadvantageous or advantageous inequity. As expected, when it came to disadvantageous inequity, pretty much no one enjoyed receiving less than the co-inventor, business partner, or manager. Advantageous inequity aversion, by contrast, was unevenly distributed. In some situations, it was absent altogether. It emerged readily in the invention and vacant lot scenarios if the pre-existing relationship was positive or neutral. It was relatively infrequent in the retail scenario, and if the relationship was negative, it disappeared across the board. In that case, people preferred to come out ahead of their counterparts. Based on his participants' choices, Lewenstein divided them into three groups: saints, loyalists, and ruthless competitors. Saints preferred equality over everything else. They were concerned with fairness for its own sake. Loyalists preferred equality in positive relationships, but in negative ones, they sought advantageous inequity. They approached the relationship socially, seeking to create loyalty by giving up their unfair advantages. Ruthless competitors always preferred getting more. The relative percentage of the saints, loyalists, and ruthless competitors were 24, 27, and 36%, respectively. 18% couldn't be classified. Then, in a follow-up, Lowenstein clarified the pre-existing relationships, providing his subject with several paragraphs of explanation as to why those relationships were positive, negative, or neutral. Under that condition, the number of saints and ruthless competitors fell, while the proportion of loyalists rose to over half, 52%. When participants received more context for the study's social scenarios and became more invested in their relationships, in other words, they gave up more to nourish and maintain them. And they are wise to do so. The results of another set of experiments show that the more someone earns in a context of inequality, the more hostile reactions from others she provokes. People dislike those at the top of the heap more when the heap itself is taller. All of these findings have something to say about why we value fairness. Our ideas about fairness are relativistic rather than absolute. In many ways, we approach fairness as a form of social signaling. People tend not to care about equality as an abstract principle. Instead, they use fairness to negotiate their place in a social hierarchy. And, for that reason, we're especially willing to give up our unfair advantages when there's the possibility of strengthening a future relationship. Could these general principles explain why advantageous inequity aversion appears earlier or more often in some societies? Possibly. But there's a lot more research to do before anything like a clear-cut answer emerges. One thing we do know is that culture plays a role. But what kind of culture? Can it be taught? Maybe if we can figure out the answer to that question, we will be able to build a world where there are more saints and loyalists and fewer ruthless competitors. And now, from the April 14th, 2014 online edition of The New Yorker, The Surprising Science of Yawning by Maria Konnikova. In 1923, Sir Francis Walsh, a British neurologist, noticed something interesting while testing the reflexes of patients who were paralyzed on one side of their bodies. When they yawned, they would spontaneously regain their motor functions. In case after case, the same thing happened. It was as if, for the 6 or so seconds the yawn lasted, the patients were no longer paralyzed. What's more, Walsh reported that some of his patients had noticed that when the fingers are extended and abducted during a yawn, they are able to flex and extend them rapidly, a thing they were unable to do at any other time. Indeed, one man added that he always waited for a yawn so that he might exercise his fingers in this way. Walsh concluded that yawning was activated by a primal center of the brain that fell outside conscious control. One's ability to yawn could thus remain completely intact even when cortical control is more or less completely abolished over the musculature of one half of the body. Yawning, then, was one of our most primitive fundamental behaviors, a conclusion that echoed Charles Darwin's observation in 1838 that seeing a dog and horse and man yawn makes me feel how much all animals are built on one structure. Yawning is one of the first things we learn to do. Learn may not even be quite the right word. Johanna de Vries, a professor of obstetrics at Bruges University, Amsterdam, has discovered that the human fetus yawns during its first trimester in the womb. And unless we succumb to neurodegenerative disease, yawning is something we keep doing throughout our lives. You don't decide to yawn, Robert Provine, a neuroscientist and the author of Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond, told me. You just do it. You're playing out a biological program. We yawn unconsciously, and we yawn spontaneously. We can't yawn on command, and we sometimes can't stop ourselves from letting out a big yawn, even at the most inopportune times. Case in point, Sasha Obama's infamous yawn during her father's 2013 inaugural address. But what precisely are we accomplishing with all this yawning? If it's so evolutionarily old, it must be doing something important to have survived. In 400 BC, Hippocrates speculated that yawning was somehow related to fever. We yawned to expel the bad air that had accumulated inside our bodies, making us ill, much like the large quantities of steam that escape from cauldrons when water boils. That intuition has proved remarkably resilient. As recently as 2011, the psychologist Gordon Gallup argued that the yawn is a cooling mechanism for the brain and the body. But the evidence for those theories has been decidedly mixed, and for now, the physiological function of the yawn remains elusive. As Provine puts it, yawning may have the dubious distinction of being the least understood common human behavior. A reliable clue to why we yawn may come from when precisely we do so. We usually think of yawning as a signal of sleepiness or boredom, one of the reasons Sasha Obama's yawn seems so inappropriate. Boredom, hunger, fatigue, these are all states in which we find our attention drifting and our focus becoming more and more difficult to maintain. A yawn, then, may serve as a signal for our bodies to perk up, a way of making sure we stay alert. When the psychologist Ronald Banninger, a professor emeritus at Temple University, tested this theory in a series of laboratory studies, he found that yawning is more frequent when stimulation is lacking. In fact, a yawn is usually followed by an increased movement and physiological activity, which suggests that some sort of waking up has taken place. However, we yawn most reliably of all when we see or hear others yawning, whether or not we happen to be feeling particularly drowsy or bored or anxious or hungry ourselves. It's a phenomenon known as contagious yawning. We also yawn when we so much as think about yawning. In one of Provine's studies, 88% of people who were instructed to think of yawns yawned themselves within 30 minutes. We yawn when we read about it. One reason my enthusiasm for studying contagion diminished is because everything causes yawning, Provine says. Are you yawning yet? Why are yawns so contagious? Does the fact that we catch them from one another shed light on their underlying function? One possibility is that contagious yawning serves as a way of showing empathy. While all vertebrate mammals experience spontaneous yawning, only humans and our closest relatives, chimpanzees, seem to experience the contagious effect, a sign that there may be a deeper social meaning to the experience. What's more, while spontaneous yawning occurs in the womb, contagious yawning develops only later in life, as does empathy. Children younger than 5 don't yawn any more often when watching videos of yawns than they would normally. But yawning a lot doesn't necessarily make someone particularly empathetic. When Bartholomew and Cerulli observed more than 300 individuals, both in the lab and at home, noting how many times they yawned while watching a 3-minute yawning video, they found consistent differences among the subjects. It didn't matter how empathetic or aloof they tested to be, some were simply more susceptible to the contagion than others. The only factor that proved relevant, in fact, was age. Older people were less likely to catch a yawn than their younger counterparts. Unless we also think the older we get, the less empathetic we are, the relationship seems highly suspect. A 2010 review of the contagion literature conducted by the Stanford University psychologist Yoon and Tenney came to a similar conclusion, finding little evidence that contagion and empathy were in any way causally related. Rather than empathy, the contagious nature of yawning may be highlighting something very different. We're getting insight into the human herd. Yawning as a primal form of sociality, Provine says. Yawning may be, at its root, a mechanism of social signaling. When we yawn, we are communicating with one another. We are sending an external sign of something internal, be it our boredom, or our anxiety, our fatigue, or our hunger. All moments when we may need a helping hand. In fact, yawning may be the opposite of what we generally think. It's less likely a signal that you're tired than a signal that it's time for everyone around you to act. At its most fundamental, a yawn is a form of communication, one of the most basic mechanisms we have for making ourselves understood to others without words. It's often said that behavior doesn't leave fossils, Provine says. But with yawning, you are looking at a behavioral fossil. You're getting an insight into how all of behavior once was. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.